Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the somewhat controversial voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Good afternoon.
you always give the time of day. Good afternoon.
Well, it's the afternoon.
Well, it could potentially be the morning or the evening when people listen to this. This always happens.
This is true. Well, just hello then.
Now, I say somewhat controversial because you, mister, have faced a bit of a backlash this week. Mainly to do with your comment. Well, I say mainly. Only to do with your comment. You don't receive backlash all the time. Kepa.
Yeah.
Now, you were very vocal last week in your opinion on that situation, and you put a lot of feelings out in this podcast and also online on Twitter, and received some opposition, both from goalkeepers, which surprised me, but also some pro footballers weighed into the argument as well. What are your thoughts now on the situation a week later?
Still very similar, and that's not me being stubborn to the situation. I just... And without going over it in too much detail again, because I feel like we've done that way too much over the past week and so many conversations about it. And interestingly today that he was reinstated and had a very good game, by the way. My feelings with this were that now that we know a little bit more about the situation, it was a mistake from Sarri. And that's come out and been admitted. He thought that Kepa was injured. And Kepa wasn't injured. Kepa was wasting time. Kepa, imagine putting yourself in Kepa's shoes. You've played a very good game of football. You've kept a clean sheet. You're about to go to a penalty shootout in a final, unexpectedly, because they were playing against Man City, who should have won the game in normal time. You know, everyone predicted it was going to be very comfortable after the 6-0 defeat. So if you're Kepa and you know that your manager's made a mistake, he's substituting you, not because Willy Caballero is better at penalties, like some people have said. That wasn't even on their mind. At all. It was a mistake from Sarri because he thought you were injured. Now, what do you do? You know that you're not injured. You know he's made an error. So you say, no, I'm absolutely okay. If Sarri at that point says, sorry, my bad. Go on, you carry on. And says to Willy Caballero, go and sit down. He's okay. It's done. But it was then Sarri with that incredible show on the touchline, walking down the tunnel, coming back, flailing his arms, etc., etc. Now, I do agree at the point that it gets to that point, then at some point, one of them needs to cave. And obviously, in the end, it was Sarri that caved. It probably should have been Kepa at that point. But it does not hide us from the fact that it was Sarri's error. And Kepa did what he did to be involved in the penalty shootout. And I still believe, even now, he would have saved Aguero's shot. Because I think about it. Now, as much as that all happens, imagine, we can all experience this, where you've had that red miss, where you feel so angry about something because you know you've been wronged. Kepa had that. But then once that dies down and he's in the huddle and he realises what's happened and that he's the centre of attention, he's going to be feeling a bit weird about the situation. He might be a little bit overly hyped, a little bit overly pumped up. He might be feeling a bit of regret, because how many times have we had that in life where you have the red miss and then 5 minutes later you're like, what have I just done? And I think he goes into that penalty shootout, he is not in the right state of mind. He is not 100% where he needs to be, because we haven't seen a ball squirm through him like that throughout the season. So I don't expect him, or I expect him to make that save if he is in the right frame of mind, which he didn't. So I do think that whole situation cost him and Chelsea the penalty shootout.
There is some grey area here as well, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I'll just start quickly with Sarri's comments after the win today over Fulham. Kepa is a man. He understood the mistake. He was able to react very well. Now, the grey area here that I'm referring to is the fact that Kepa came out and said it was a misunderstanding. Maurizio Sarri came out and said it was a misunderstanding. But then Kepa was dropped for the game against Spurs. So what's happening there?
They're saving face. It's as simple as that. And I won't bore you. I've actually just bored you on our radio show about a situation I had that was very similar. Without going into full detail, it was where there was an error from the school that I was at. Now, I did something I shouldn't have done, but it was based on their error. They admitted that it was their error, but they had to do something. Otherwise, other students, they knew what had happened to me and what I had done. It would have then set a bit of a precedent. So they were like, look, we have to do something, but we'll meet you in the middle. And rather than giving you what we should give you in terms of detentions or suspensions, we're going to give you something very light. But at least it shows the other students that this isn't acceptable to react in this way, even though you were right. This is what's happened to Kepa. They would have pulled him aside. They'll have been like, look, we've messed up. We thought you were injured. We didn't realise you were time-wasting. Completely our error. But if we let you off scot-free, what message does that send out? It sends out a message of weakness. So they're saying to him, look, we're going to fine you a week's wages. They probably haven't, by the way. That's my bet. We'll never know, but they probably haven't. They probably said, look, we'll put it in the press that we're going to fine you a week's wages. Or they'll have made the donation to the charity they said they would. Great. Fantastic. That's a good PR stunt. That's tick number one. Secondly, can we play you in the next game? They'd have gone to both Caballero and Kepa and said, look, again, we need to brush this over and just make sure that nobody, or this doesn't go any further. So what we're going to do, Willy Caballero, you're going to play one game, agreed. You go and play, enjoy it, do as well as you can. Kepa will come in the next game. And it has worked perfectly. Willy Caballero came in, didn't have a lot to do, but played a good game. Kepa's come back in today and was very, very good. Arguably his game of the season. So in a weird way, all of this negativity and this bizarre situation that we've seen has certainly worked out positively for Chelsea, certainly worked out positively for Sarri. His mistake has certainly been hidden to a large extent. And even in some ways, it's worked out positively for Kepa.
Okay, what do you think on this situation and Kepa's season as a whole? Let us know on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, on Facebook, search GK Union, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net.
Oh, Keeper Capers.
Okay, we're in League Two for this week's Keeper Capers, mate, at Stadium MK. MK Dons v Crawley. Now, this is an interesting situation because there was a big punt from the MK Dons goalkeeper, Stuart Moore. Danny Ballman, the Crawley midfielder, misjudged the flight of the ball. It bounced once. Goalkeeper Glenn Morris came out. The attacker, Kieran Agard, got in front of the keeper, nicked it in front of him and slotted it into an empty net.
It's a goal that we see quite a lot. And whether it's the keeper's fault or the defender's fault, it's hard to say without knowing exactly what's happened. Because we don't know if it's just purely a misjudgment from the defender, which if it is, then he would certainly hold his hands up and take the blame. Or whether it was a communication error, whether Glenn Morris thought the ball was coming through, so shouted keepers, at which point if the defender's left it, then Glenn Morris has to take responsibility and clean up the situation. And we see this goal a lot, that communication between defence and goalkeeper. And I know we're going to touch on Hugo Lloris and Kieran Trippier as well, because there's similarities to both of these situations. But certainly with this one, what's ended up happening with Glenn Morris, as soon as his defender or the midfielder hasn't headed it and it's come through, he knows he's got a decision. He either needs to come and try and clean out everything, which is exactly what he did, or you retreat and you make it a one-on-one and trust yourself in a one-on-one. He's obviously thought, the moment that it's gone over them, that he could get there and at least get something on it. Unfortunately for him, the striker just nipped in ahead of him, got a touch around him and made the finish.
Didn't massively try and clean him out though, did he? He was almost a bit tentative in his efforts.
Maybe. I mean, there's obviously, he was outside the area. There's always the worry of making a foul, which would then be a red card. So, look, it's a difficult situation for a goalkeeper. It's all about judgment. If you think you can get there, you need to go, and you need to go wholeheartedly to get the ball. If you think it's going to be a 50-50, you could say it's the same. If you think it's 30-70 in their favour, at that point, my advice would always be then to stay deep and just accept that it's a one-on-one and see if you can make the save. And you can have an argument with your defender midfielder afterwards, but you give yourself a slightly better chance. But I think, watching the footage, that going through his head, he would have been thinking, if I take him out, if I take him down, I could well get sent off. It could be a penalty and a sending off, or certainly a free kick and a sending off, which would then put his team in a really bad position.
Okay, well, as an onlooker, those sorts of goals drive me mad. And we're going to talk about Hugo Lloris and Kieran Trippier here, because I still can't get my head around how, at the very top of the game, this kind of thing happens.
Well, in some ways, more so at the top of the game for the fact that it's harder to communicate. Imagine being the goalkeeper and a defender where you've got 50,000 fans screaming and you're trying to communicate. And it was really interesting when you watched the goal again, where there was moments of hesitation. Do you come? Do you stay? You could see initially that Lloris had decided to stay, but then there's a bit of a sign from Trippier to say, come for it. So then he comes. But then at that point, Trippier thinks that he stayed. So he tries to pass it back. So it's like three or four things in succession that have all happened perfectly, or not so perfect if you're a Tottenham fan, in order to create the goal that obviously Trippier scored. There's a couple of other things as well to note, because there is the argument that Trippier should be playing outside the post. You know, it's a bit of a classic one, but if you are a defender, you are taught to play outside of the post where possible. From Lloris's point of view, and I was asked, whose fault is it? And it's, again, without being in the situation yourself, it's hard to know exactly, but it's a little bit of both, and at the same time, a little bit of neither. It's a bit of bad luck at the same time. But certainly Lloris, looking at that again, he will have wished that he'd have just stayed and stuck with his initial judgment. You often get that one as well, and goalkeepers will be able to relate to this, where you shout away or you stay on your line and ask for them to pass it back, and the ball ends up creeping closer and closer and closer to you. And before you know it, the defender's only 10 yards from goal, and they might then kick it out for a throw-on. And ordinarily, it then means an argument ensues. Why didn't you come for it? It was in your area. Come and get it. You know, help us out. And you get that kind of argument going on. It happens all the time. But at least it's not a goal. And that's the point, in that you don't mind having that argument after. Try and make the right decision. But if you've made the wrong decision, you just got to be careful if you then try to change that decision halfway through. The whole joke about goalkeepers, the whole keepers away shout, you know, and I certainly did that myself in my younger years. Keepers away. And you realise halfway that you're not going to get there. You change your mind, but you've already killed your defence at that point because they're expecting you to come. And if you don't, how often do we see the striker have a free header because of your poor communication? So it's tough. Ordinarily, the more experienced you get, the better you become at communication and communicating with your defence. But as we see, even the very best have issues with it.
I understand all of those arguments, and I'm on board with all of them apart from one. The level of volume within a stadium. I know you're saying there's 50,000 fans screaming and it's hard to hear. I don't buy into that. Lloris and Trippier are, what, 10, 20 yards from each other? If you shout loudly enough on a football pitch, you're going to be able to hear each other there, surely.
There's a lot of people, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of people shouting. And yes, you'd be surprised. Look, obviously, I've had the pleasure of playing in some big stadiums, and it was tough. If anything, you find yourself becoming quieter, or I certainly did in the bigger stadiums, because you knew you were shouting sometimes, and it was pointless. Whereas when you're playing non-league, you know, you can hear the guy behind you with his dog giving you all sorts of abuse. When you're playing in a massive stadium, sometimes there's not a lot you can do unless they are that close to you. So look, we don't know. This is what I'm saying. It could have been that. It might not have been. We don't know how good the communication is between them. You know, what Lloris has shouted, has he been clear with his command? Which, again, goalkeepers listening in, you don't want to talk too much, but it might be as simple as set me or pass it to me, or of course just keepers ordinarily would mean Trippier, leave it, shield it for me. But there's so much information you'd want to give. You know, if you're Lloris, you'd almost want to say to Trippier, shield the ball for me so I can come and pick it up. But you can't do that. You can't say that many words. So ordinarily the shout keepers should be enough for Trippier to know what to do. Now we have to assume that Hugo Lloris shouted keepers, which if he did, then maybe that shifts the blame slightly to Trippier. If he didn't shout loud enough, maybe that shifts the blame slightly more to Hugo Lloris. It's such a tough one to say who is exactly to blame, but it's a goal that we have seen and we will see over and over, unfortunately.
This week's guest is yet another man who enjoyed a colourful career between the sticks. He bravely crossed divides in East Anglia and the Midlands. He played in an FA Cup final and he even bagged a taste of Europe in the UEFA Cup. Currently goalkeeper coach at Charlton Athletic, Andy Marshall. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
How are you doing, Matt? You okay?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to have you on. Now, Andy, we've spoken to a lot of goalkeepers, naturally, on this podcast, and a fair few have started their careers at an early age. Joe Hart springs to mind, as does Jack Butland, even Alec Chamberlain, who started very young at Colchester. All of those, however, were handed their pro debuts in the bottom tier. It was different for you, wasn't it? You were 19 in that first full season with Norwich in the very top flight of the Premier League. Brian Gunn got injured. Mid-match, on you came.
That's correct. Very frustrated at that moment in time. Well, the 6 months building up to that, and I was actually wondering where my career was going to go, because as an 18, coming on 19-year-old, how it used to be, you used to have youth team, reserves and first team. And back in the day, if you weren't playing in the first team as a first team goalkeeper, you would play in the reserves. Not even a question about it. And I ended up becoming third choice goalkeeper at Norwich City and not being able to play any games anywhere. Too old for the youth team. Not required for the reserves and not ready for the first team at that moment in time. So it became a very, very frustrating period of football. And I was actually getting to the point where I was looking elsewhere. I was looking for different career opportunities. And maybe that was my bit of inexperience and people not being able to sit down and explain to me the frustrations and the time you'd have to wait. And it reached a point that I was ready to walk away, and it sounds quite bizarre. But this is how football changes, and these are the experiences that I take from when I played, and I try and put them across to the goalkeepers that I work with, goalkeepers that I have worked with, and any young goalkeepers that I talk to. And I might sound a little bit of a has-been when I talk about it, but these are the harsh realities of football. You either in it or you're out of it. And when you're out of it, you've got to learn how to deal with the adversities that are thrown your way. And, you know, for me, almost giving up football, and it sounds bizarre now, looking back when I was 18, coming on 19, to then 6 months later, making my Premier League debut live on Sky against Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, and it was an interesting time for Norwich then, wasn't it? I mean, they'd been in Europe with that huge win over Bayern Munich the previous season. Everything seemed rosy, but a bad run towards the end of your first season saw them go down, kind of against the odds, in a way. As a 19-year-old, that must have been a real baptism of fire for you. Do you think, in a strange way, it kind of helped shape your career thereafter?
It did shape me. If I be brutally honest, I wasn't ready for it. I think if at the time we didn't have goalkeeper coaches, and it sounds bizarre, but there was not even part-time or full-time goalkeeper coaches. And I think if I'd have had that, that would have helped me massively deal with the adversities that were going to come my way as a Premier League goalkeeper. But I wasn't ready for it. And I can look back on that, but I don't look back and regret anything that happened, because I had great experiences. It thrust me into the limelight. I played 25 games or 24 games that season. We got to the semi or quarterfinals of the FA Cup, and just had some great experiences, and then getting called up for England under-21s. So no regrets whatsoever, but I look at how the modern day game is with the coaching staff that are involved in it, and I look at the goalkeepers that I work with, and I think, was I really truly ready? No, I wasn't. But at that age, you probably are never truly ready. You know, Richard Lee, when he was thrown into it, I don't think Richard would, you know, I think Richard would admit he wasn't ready for it at that moment in time. But, you know, you've thrown these adversities, you've thrown these challenges, and it's how you deal with it.
Yeah, well, I want to talk to you about the debut itself, because I'll always remember mine. Mine was actually because we were having a really good cup run, and it was the game before the quarterfinal of the FA Cup. Ray Lewington decided to rest Alec Chamberlain and play me, but he decided not to tell me until 3 hours before kickoff, because by knowing 2-3 days prior, I might have got nervous. The interesting thing is, he had told all my family, and so they all knew that I was playing. I didn't, and I only found out at the pre-match meal. But in some ways, it really helped me. It was still a really surreal experience walking out onto the pitch, seeing the, I think, the 12,000 fans, let's say, Preston North End on a Tuesday night. But I just remember the feeling being really surreal. Like, finally, you'd watched it for years, and you were actually walking out. How was it for you actually coming on, being thrust in like that?
Yeah, as you say, mine was slightly different. If I remember right, Rich, didn't Ray tell your family so that they could come?
Yeah.
So that they could come to the game.
That's right.
Would that be right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I was very fortunate, like yourself, good support from the family. My dad, even when I was a sub, would come to every game. So away at Nottingham Forest, it was only after 7 minutes. Fortunately, I had the mentality that I would always prepare myself as if I was playing, even when I was sub, and I'd been sub for quite a few months. But I always had that mentality of, I'll prepare myself, I'm ready to play, I'm ready to come on. And within 7 minutes, Brian Gunn's gone down, he's broke his ankle and broke his leg and dislocated his ankle. A very horrendous injury. And I just remember thinking, the second it happened, it's just that split thing, Rich, where you go, oh crap. And you do. And you think, this is what I've been after my whole life. This is what I've wanted. Crap, it's going to happen. Forest Stadium was getting redeveloped. The Trent End was shut at that moment in time. So there was around 22,000 there, 20 or 25,000. But there was no one behind the goal that I came on. Now, I'm stood on the sidelines, and I'm getting stripped off, and I'm stood there, and the manager just said to me, John Dean, listen, Mark, just go on, just do your stuff. He's obviously trying to play the whole thing down. And I remember just standing there, and I could just hear this one guy in the crowd behind me. You've got 25,000 people there chanting, shouting, screaming. And I just remember hearing this one guy stood in the crowd going, Marshall, big Stan's coming for you. Big Stan. Stan Collymore. And I'm 19 years old. Big Stan was in, you know, the prime of his career, and he's just before he's got his move to Liverpool. And I'm thinking, oh, crap. So, you know, it's just that, them surreal moments that just make you remember your debut coming on, and the second half going down in front of what was our fans, the Norwich fans, but also the away fans as well, and just the noise, Rich. The noise was intense. You don't quite realise it when you stood on the side. When you're on the pitch, you don't quite realise the intensity of the noise. And it's just bizarre little sequences like that remind you of your career.
Do you think that goalkeepers should come in later, Andy? I mean, there are examples currently, not that many. Donnarumma at AC Milan, Alban Lafont at Fiorentina, playing as teenagers. David De Gea came in at Atletico Madrid very early. Do you think at the very top flight, goalkeepers should be delayed until they're slightly older?
No, I don't. And I've had a big bugbear about this for years. And I think I've probably spoken to Richard about it. For me, and this is my truthful view on it, is everyone used to say goalkeepers don't develop till they're 27, 28. And that was probably true. But the reason why was because they wasn't getting the correct coaching and training at the very early ages. And it's been a massive bugbear for me. You look at the outfield players, how it used to be when me and Rich were coming through. They would have coaching and training from ex-professional players. Goalkeepers would have nothing. So it wouldn't be till you came into the building on a full-time basis that you would get this type of coaching and training that you would need to develop. So already you're 3, 4, 5 years behind where you need to be. Now, even in today's modern game, that coaching needs to be of the highest possible level to bring these goalkeepers through. So when they do get to 16, 18, 20, they're in a position that they're ready to play football matches. And I think, for me, in the past, it's where it's been let down. I think it's getting better now. I think where there's these professional goalkeeping academies and schools, it's helping goalkeepers develop at a lot better level where they're able to go into clubs. And you find a lot of the time that some of these centres, these academies, development centres, they don't have the goalkeeping coaching that's of the level of some of these schools, or where the ex-professionals are actually going out and doing the coaching. So I'm not of the thing of they have to be older. For me, it's all about the coaching when at the very early ages.
Do you know what? We're going to touch on the coaching aspect throughout this, because it's obviously a lot of what you're going to talk about, I'm assuming, has led you to become the coach that you are now. And I've watched a few of your warm-ups, and I want to talk to you more about that further in the podcast. But you touched on the fact that you can effectively fast-forward a goalkeeper's development, because same as you, until I was 16, I didn't really have a goalkeeper coach. So I always felt that you're always learning on the job. You needed the games in order to progress. Whereas, you know, to give an obvious example, if you're going to learn to drive, you don't learn by getting yourself on the road and having crash after crash. You get lessons and you get taught. And effectively, of course, that's what a goalkeeper coach does. You can have quality time going through game-specific situations in order to fast-forward your development and make sure you're ready that much sooner.
Absolutely.
Have you got certain ways yourself, or a certain methodology yourself, when it comes to coaching?
For me, you've got to get the basic principles in place, Rich, where you've got to have the work rate. If you've got no one, if you've got someone that doesn't want to work, you're never going to go anywhere with them, because they're going to cut corners. They've got to be able to listen. The capability of being able to listen, whether you're a young player or whether you're an older player. Some of the best players that I ever worked with, I was very fortunate that I worked with Shay Given and I coached Shay Given. And when I was coaching Shay, you know, there's me that I had a semi-decent career, but Shay was one of the top goalkeepers. And I'm telling Shay certain things that he should and should not be doing in games and in training. And Shay stood there and he's listening so intently that you're going, this is why he played at the top for so long. This is why he had the career that he had. Because the good ones, they listen and they want to learn. Doesn't matter whether they're 16, 17, 36 or 37, they want to learn and they can't stop learning. The ones that you talk to and they're looking through you, they got a limited time in the career, because everybody gets found out, and they do. They always get found out because people have bad times. Now, I like to coach goalkeepers on a level where you train harder than you'll ever have to play, where you will have to deal with things in training a lot harder than you'll have to deal with things in games, with the idea that, in principle, them things in games then should become second nature and hopefully not be a shock to you when it happens. But when you train at them high levels, you don't have so far to fall when you have your bad times. So if you can imagine yourself climbing up a mountain and getting 3/4 of the way there and you go through a bad time. Now, if you don't have them basic principles of how to survive mountain climbing, you're going to fall all the way back down to the bottom. Then it's a long way back up again. But if you have them basic principles in place and you know how to deal with things, you might only fall to halfway. And that's the idea behind it. It's about making sure that when you have them bad times, and everyone does, you don't fall from being an 8 out of 10 to a 4 out of 10. You fall to maybe a 6 as a maximum. So my principles are work rate. You've got to have the capability to listen. You've got to have the will and desire to want to play football and want to be able to improve every single day you come in, because the day you don't think that you've learned something, positively or negatively, that's the day when really you shouldn't be playing football at a professional level. And that maybe at a semi-professional level, maybe you're never going to reach the goals that you want to go on and reach.
It's interesting you say that, because one of my thoughts towards this, the, I suppose, the science of improvement is quite a basic one, which is stretching comfort zones, making sure that you're doing things that that test you. You know, I've seen goalkeeper coaches or goalkeepers work where they might be served 100 volleys and they catch all 100. And I know I'm watching it thinking, you haven't improved at all there. Like, you're doing something that's very, very comfortable for you. I made a point of coming to your game recently, AFC Wimbledon. I came really early because I wanted to watch. I'm always intrigued by goalkeeper coaches, the warm-ups they do. And the thing that really struck me with your warm-up was how hard you strike the ball at your goalkeepers. You know, I know some, and it's just, I'm interested to know your thoughts on this, because I know that some in a warm-up for a match might go really easy-ozy, kind of getting them ready for the game to an extent, but in some ways they're not, because then it comes to a game and they're not actually facing shots that soft. Whereas the bit that really struck me was you really worked both the lads really hard, and you were really striking the ball quite fiercely.
It was something I was like as a player, so maybe I've taken an element of that, Rich. But my view on it is, I've got a young goalkeeper in Dylan Phillips, 23, 24 years old. Came into the team at the start of the season, maybe had a little bit of an impression of where he felt he should be at, and I maybe had a different view where I thought he was at. And he did okay, and maybe felt as though he could maybe feel unjustified why he came out of the side. Eventually got back into the side, and I believe came back in as a stronger goalkeeper. Now, when I see Dylan warming up, I look at him in a certain way that I think, you know what, I've got to work you hard because I've got to get you mentally right for this game. Now, at the moment, we're playing Saturday to Saturday. Now, if that we were playing Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, I would change that warm-up intensity and lower the amount of reps that we do and make it not so intense. Keep the intensity, but not so many reps. But when we're playing Saturday to Saturday, I like to make sure that I get everything that I can out of him, because you can see when you've played the game for a while, like yourself, Rich, you'll be able to see it when you know a goalkeeper's ready to play, when you know he's getting right warmed up and he's ready to go. And you can see that. So for me, I need to get Dylan Phillips as an inexperienced young goalkeeper to that point that he's ready to play. If I'm dealing with a senior goalkeeper, I may change that intensity of how hard I hit the ball depending on how that goalkeeper operates. But I guess it's that classic, it's horses for courses, and you have to pick what you believe is the right warm-up for the right type of goalkeeper.
Okay, well, that's your coaching side of your game, Andy. Just going back to those playing days, we've spoken about Norwich, obviously it was your first club. You had a solid few years there, arguably the best of your career, I suppose you could say. In that final campaign at Carrow Road, you kept an impressive 16 clean sheets, you were named Player of the Year, and then you departed to local rivals Ipswich Town. Talk us through that one.
I've been at Norwich a long time, and you just feel you need a new challenge. I love the club, and to this day I still love the club. I think it's a fabulous club, run by very good people in Delia Smith and Michael Wynne-Jones, and it reaches a point that if I'd have signed another contract there, which I was offered, I could see myself not really moving to test and try new things. An opportunity to go and play in the Premier League, European football with Ipswich, something that I'd, you know, had a sort of taste with Norwich when they had the European run. I was a young goalkeeper then. And it was a great opportunity. Was it the right one? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, it was an opportunity that I needed to get back in the Premier League and start playing and testing myself.
So it's an interesting one, this, because I think players get a lot of stick, right? Players get a lot of stick for moving to a rival club.
Yeah.
How much, in your opinion, is there an onus or a responsibility on a player to not do that? Because ultimately this is a living, right? You need to earn wages. You want to play at the highest possible level that you can.
Yeah. I understand fans' points of view. I mean, you know, it could be very easily turned around and said, well, if you got an opportunity from a local supplier and you're working in a certain industry, you know, how could you go to that job? Yes, you increase your money, job satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. But football is different, and I get that, because the rivalry of the fans, and football's more than just a job. It's a lifestyle, and people will treat you that way, how they feel they need to treat you, because of the lifestyle choices that they make. So I do get it. I do understand why people were annoyed, upset, frustrated. But at the end of it, you make a choice, and you make that choice based on what you believe is the right career opportunity at that moment in time.
I mean, I had a slightly similar situation. So I went from Brentford to Fulham at the very back end of my career.
Yep.
Probably similar reasons as to why I did it. It was the excitement of going somewhere where I thought I might stand more of a challenge of playing. A club yep. that, you know, I'd always looked at from afar and was quite impressed with the club. But I know the moment I went, the amount of abuse that I got on Twitter and all the other social media was a lot more than I ever imagined it would be. Yeah. I actually very naively thought it would just happen and people would understand that, you know, I went there to try and get some games and experience something different. Did you, you mentioned you got a bit of criticism. Was it, I guess it was slightly different back then, but did you experience a lot of that? Was it fans' forums? Was it anything personal?
Rich, you know, social media wasn't around like it is now. You know, Facebook, I presume, was just about coming in. I wasn't a big social media person back then. So the stick wasn't as... It wasn't in your living room, if you want to put it that way. You could shut your door and it would be put away. But I was totally aware of the... how bad it became in the end. The rivalry and how the fans were. They made their point very clear when I went back there and played against Ipswich. I played against Norwich for Ipswich. The Norwich fans made it very clear. And, you know, they were very, very abusive towards me. But for me, that's part and parcel of the game. I've grown up in the era of playing football where you have to put up with that. It's just how it was. You know, these days it might not be socially accepted, but... it was how it was. But all it did is it made me focus more on my game. It made me focus more about the challenges that were going to come my way when I played the games. I remember the first time I went back to Carrow Road playing for Ipswich, and I got dogs abuse, absolute dogs abuse. And I was on the coach, and Joe Royal was the manager, and we pulled up at the stadium at Norwich, and you know, there was thousands of fans out there. They were throwing things at the coach. There was placards up. I was getting dogs abuse. And Joe just stood up at the front of the coach, turned around, looked at me, goes, go on, Marsh, get off. He goes, because they're not here for us. They're here for you. So it was that sort of lighthearted banter, though, that allowed me to go on, win the game 2-0. And I played a good game. And it always managed to make me raise my game and focus that a little bit harder. It was tough looking back at it, but they're decisions I made. And decisions you make in your life, you've got to face the consequences of them.
You certainly celebrated as well. I watched the footage of that game, and you certainly went for it.
Well, I'd taken enough stick in a warm-up. I'd taken enough stick the whole game. That was my little moment. So, you enjoy them little moments when you can get them.
Now, that time with Ipswich obviously included that UEFA Cup run. I have to say, as a player, often you wait ages to play in Europe. It's the ultimate goal. Your run in particular, Avenir Begun of Luxembourg, FK Smederevo of Serbia, and Slovan Liberec of the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
Not the biggest teams to play.
Horrendous, though, wasn't it? No, I know. It wasn't the best. It wasn't the best of runs. But, you know, they're moments you just enjoy, and you try and take out of it the best you can do. You get thrown whatever you get thrown, and you just got whoever you got to play, you've got to play. And you've got to try and beat whoever you can beat.
You moved on to Millwall thereafter. We'll briefly touch on that because that time included an FA Cup final against Man United.
Yeah, I loved my time there. I absolutely loved it. I remember getting a phone call and saying that, you know, Millwall would like to take me on loan. I just remember thinking, oh my God, Millwall, Jesus, why do I want to go to Millwall? you know, you hear the reputation about them, but I knew Ray Wilkins, and I got to know Dennis Wise, the manager at the time, and had a fabulous relationship with them, and we just had a great time. And there's sometimes you go certain clubs, and again, Rich will know this, and it's just right. It's just going to work. It's going to work for you, and it's going to work for the club. And it was. I know you said earlier that Norwich was one of my best times of my career. So was Millwall. I loved Millwall. It was one of the times I probably enjoyed playing football the most, which is no coincidence that then we had a European run and an FA Cup final. So a fantastic time at Millwall I had.
And speaking about that final in particular, you made a couple of great saves that day from Keane and Ronaldo.
Yeah, and it was, listen, we were up against it. We had a couple of players out injured and suspended. You're playing Man United, you do well with your strongest side. But yeah, I made a pretty decent save off Roy Keane. And when Roy came to Aston Villa a few years ago as a coach, I was working with him, I was a coach and he was a coach. And we sat there in the office one day and Roy's on his computer, which, by the way, he didn't know how to switch on. So every time I have to go to his laptop and switch it on for him, and that's no word of a lie. He turned around and he just sat there and he looked at me. I could see him looking at me and I thought, oh God, he has this sort of glare, and he just sort of glared at me. And this is after a few weeks of being there, and he's glaring at me. He goes, Marshall, he goes, you stopped me from ever scoring an FA Cup goal, didn't you? I went, yeah, I did. He went, yeah, I thought so. And he just put his head down and carried on. It was just a bit of a surreal moment, because to me, Roy Keane was always a complete legend, and to be sharing an office with him, working with him, and then, you know, to be having that conversation, which was very brief, it was just very nice.
You mentioned Villa there, where you worked with him. It's an interesting time at Villa, because you were there for, what, the best part of 4 years?
4 years as a player and 4 years as a coach.
So, with regards to being a player,
yeah,
how does that play out? Because ultimately you were a third choice from looking at everything. You were there with Stuart Taylor, who has actually become notorious for being a goalkeeper in that position. And you were there for 4 years, but you didn't actually play a game.
No, I actually took over from Stuart Taylor. So Stewie was the number three there. And we had Brad Friedel, Brad Guzan and myself. And I was brought in just on a 12-month contract just to cover that space, which is what I did. I then left at the end of my contract. Had a really good time, really enjoyed it. It's a fabulous club, really well-run club. Gone through some dark times more recently. But when I was there, it was going through some very, very good times. And then I was brought back in the second year. They asked me to come back. That then got extended into the third year and the fourth year. In the second year, Brad Friedel then left, and Guzan took over, and I became the number two. So I had a couple of seasons where I was number two, and then Shay Given was brought in, and I dropped back down to number three again. But I was at the end of my career. I was 37, 38, nearly 39. So for me, at the end of my career, reached a point where injuries were catching up on me. I probably wasn't in a position that I could play every week anyway. The role suited me perfectly, and it also enabled me to start stepping into the coaching role, which I think Villa could see that as well, because while I was still playing, they were getting me doing a lot of coaching with the young lads, getting a lot of coaching with the 23s, and it almost just became a natural progression. I had 6 months away from the club, and after that 6 months, I was brought back as first-team goalkeeping coach.
And you played on some interesting managers as well, O'Neill, McLeish, Houllier, and Lambert. Yeah. You know, massive differences between the four.
I've been very fortunate in my career, Rich, where I've had all different, like yourself, probably all different levels of managers and all different characters. But when you're at a club of Aston Villa's stature and you've got them type of managers there, you know, ones that have won some exceptional trophies, it was great, and it was great to learn off. And you know, I look at it now, and I look at every manager I was there with. Even though I was still playing, I was learning and I was absorbing all the information that they were saying, the goods and the bads, you know, because not every manager got it right and not every manager ever gets it right. So you've got to try and take all the good and the bad points out of every situation. But I was very fortunate, and I'm transferring a lot of them skills, whether it's actual coaching skills, management skills, or how you just deal with situations. I've taken that on board from some of these managers that I've worked with, all of the managers that I've worked with. And for me, it's been priceless, and it's been a great opportunity for me. It's to help me develop my coaching skills.
And on that note, I mean, because I'm looking from afar and I hear bits and pieces, and it really seems like you've got a modern approach to goalkeeping. So I'm keen to know, with your coaching, what is, and it's very different now, obviously, when you're a player, there are certain objectives, and a lot of players have similar goals that they're looking to attain. As a coach, it can be easy to be at a club and be quite comfortable, but have you set goals for yourself? Have you set aims, objectives that you want to do in the coaching world?
Yeah. I've been very fortunate that I started off immediately as a first-team goalkeeping coach at a very, very big club. And I want to go back there. I want to go back to the Premier League, you know, and if we can get the right support at Charlton financially, then there's no reason why we can't be looking to do something there. But I look at my coaching career and I look at how I was as a player and how I like to be treated as a player. And that's what I try and put across to the lads. And, you know, I have a couple of sayings, you know, whatever goalkeeper I go and work with, I just want them to be honest with me and I just want them to work hard. That's all I ask. Give me everything when you work and be honest with me. Because if you don't give me everything when you work, I can't help you. Because there's only so far I can take you. And if you're not honest with me, I can't trust you. So, you know, they're two very basic principles. The rest of it, there's so much involved in goalkeeping. You know, we could go on all night about it, Rich, all night. But if you have your basic principles, your basic coaching principles, everything else can work around it. And it's, I've got to be honest with my goalkeepers, and I've got to work to the levels that my goalkeepers are expected to work to as well. You know, I won't ask them to do anything that I haven't done myself, and I won't ask them to not go and do something that I won't be willing to do myself as well.
You mentioned honesty there, Andy. Now, I'm just going to bring this up because I was having a bit of a look online prior to this chat, obviously, naturally, doing a bit of research on your fine self. Now, I don't always go to Wikipedia because it can lead you down, shall we say, an unsubstantiated path. But I was looking at your Wikipedia page and a couple of other bits and pieces on fans forums. You might want to have a word with some of these keyboard warriors, because I'm just going to read you a line, and you might be aware of this already.
I don't know. I'll be honest, I don't look at it. So go on.
Right. So it said, upon you going to Norwich, said, Marshall sees the opportunity to establish himself as Norwich's number one. And despite his inability to kick the ball straight from a goal kick, brackets, often the ball went out for a throw, he became an established player. What is going on?
Sounds like we both had the same thing.
We both had the same coach. Imagine if I could kick it straight then. Come on, imagine the career I could have had. That's something I've learned. It's something I've learned to do, as Rich can now validate for me. That I've learned to kick a ball straight. It wasn't a strength of my game, and it's something that in the modern game, how the game is, the goalkeepers have got to have it, and it's something we work on every day with young Dylan Phillips and Chris Maxwell and the other goalkeepers at the football club. And it's something that I believe Dylan Phillips' game has improved on in immensely. And it was one of his weaker parts, and it's probably because of that strength of his game that's improved, that's got him in the side and kept him in the side, to be honest.
It is fascinating to see how a goalkeeper's game has changed, because you do think, even when I started, and we bring this up quite often on this, but the fact the back pass rule coming in when it did, it wasn't like as kids that meant anything. I remember as a kid, actually, at 8 years old, I'll always remember this, that the plan was always on a goal kick to try and pass it to one of my defenders, to pass it back to me so I could pick it up and do a big boom. Yeah, and that was it. I did that till I was about 14, you know, and it's... but it is now, it's changed. And so, like, even back then, and I remember, similar to yourself, I wouldn't necessarily have ever had it as a huge strength, but it was always good enough. I could always get it into an area, and that was more the goal back then.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, but that wouldn't be acceptable these days, would it? You're absolutely spot on. It was hit an area. As long as you can hit an area, there would be basically four areas. The left side, the two centre of the fields, you know, the right side of the 18, the D, the left side of the 18 of the D, and the right side. You hit them four areas, then that's all that's asked for. These days, you've got to hit on a sixpence. And I look about how much coaching, and probably the same with yourself, Rich, that we used to practice when we used to train kicking the ball. We used to just put the ball down on a six-yard box and boom as far as we could, as long as you're hitting an area. Now, they're expected to kick it out 5 yards, 10 yards, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 yards on a sixpence. You know, within 5 yards, that's what they're expected to hit. So the game has evolved, and it's evolved I think the game's brilliant. Now, I'm not one of those that goes, oh, it's better back in my day. It's not. The game's a million times better now. What I don't like is a little bit of the play acting sometimes with how some of the players can be. I think we've lost a little bit of the physical and mental toughness of players, but the quality, through the roof for me.
It's interesting you mention that. Just quickly, there was the North London Derby this weekend, and the incident with Bernd Leno struck me, where Danny Rose came in, and it was a 50-50, I guess you could say, but Bernd Leno was complaining. I mean, his shirt had been slightly ripped, but it was one of those where it looked like Danny Rose was entitled to go for the ball, but there were a lot of people afterwards suggesting that Rose should have been sent off.
Yeah. We were actually on our way to the game, so I only saw brief bits of it. But for me, it was... Football has changed for the better. It's a lot faster. It's still a contact sport. And we had a game yesterday against Doncaster, and it was a physical game. And for me, both managers and coaching staff afterwards said, great physical game. The referee let the game go. Wasn't dangerous tackles. There wasn't anything malicious. And off the top of my head, I think there's maybe one or two yellow cards. Now, we've been involved in games through this season where the ref's stopping the game every couple of minutes, and it's crazy. And there's been games where there's been like 10 yellow cards and then a red card, and you're going, but there was nothing in the game. So, you know, you've got to get the consistency from the referee. But for me, I think it's made very difficult because we're trying to take any type of contact out of a contact sport. So I don't want to go down that road because you'll get me started on something else, but I do think there's a balance that has to be met.
Sure. Now, we've talked a lot about your coaching career so far. We're just going to touch on your managerial career. 100% record.
Not bad, is it?
You obviously came in, Paul Lambert was sacked at Aston Villa and Tim Sherwood was the replacement, but for one game, it was an FA Cup win over Leicester.
Yeah, it was a great experience. I mean, I've gone from finishing my career, having 6 months out of football, and then within 8 months, 9 months, I'm managing a Premier League football team at Villa Park in front of 42,000 people in an FA Cup fifth round or whatever it was, which we won 2-1, where the club went on to play in the final. It was a surreal moment, and I can always remember there was myself and Scott Marshall where we came in at half time. We made a couple of changes in how we were playing. Tim Sherwood came in the changing room as well, literally said a couple of things. We went out, we were 1-0 down, we went on and we won the game 2-1. Tim took all the plaudits for Tim's gone in the changing room, changed the whole thing around, done this, done that. Well, the truth was, he just came in and said, listen, keep going, lads. It was myself and Scotty that made all the changes. But it was a fantastic experience, and it's something that I've been thrown back in it a little bit again, where Lee was sent off, our manager at Charlton, Lee Bowyer. He was sent off against Wimbledon. Myself and Johnny Jackson took the game halfway through, and we took the game yesterday against Doncaster Rovers, where we drew 1-1. So, you know, unfortunately, Lee's got another couple of game bans, so I'm going to be involved on that as well. But it's something that I embrace. It's something I really enjoy. I don't want to go into management, before you ask that question. I love the role that I do, and the good thing with working with Lee and Johnny Jackson, the assistant manager, is they give me freedom to be involved in it. As a player, my strength was always organisation and communication. It always a big strength of mine. And as a coach and when I needed to step up to be an assistant manager, I like to think it's something that contributes very, very well as well.
Well, we've spoken about him already, one of your former managers, Paul Lambert, who is at Ipswich as we speak, Daniel Farker at Norwich. I guess you're the perfect person to speak to about this, because as things stand, they currently bookend the championship. Norwich at the top, Ipswich at the very bottom. How do you view the season for both of those teams, and where do you see it going for Norwich and Ipswich?
I think this best describes it. We were very fortunate. We played Norwich, I think, a week before the season started, and we beat at Charlton, we beat them 2-0. And we convincingly beat Norwich 2-0. Norwich were, for me, a very poor side that day. And I remember I phoned up one of my friends and I said to him, I'm sorry, but you're relegation all day. And I said, Ipswich, relegation all day. Waghorn had just been sold, I believe, to Derby. And I said, listen, both clubs are really going to struggle. No investment in either club. And I honestly thought both clubs could go down. And that's how it looked. And after playing against Norwich as well, I think, you know, I was thinking, really, really felt for them. Couldn't be further from the truth in regards to Norwich. Unbelievable. Again, the same Palo I spoke to, he goes to a lot of the games and he just says their football is just phenomenal, which has shown the investment that they've put in the youth team, because a lot of them players have come through the youth team or come through the development side of the football club, and they've shown a lot of faith in young players. But you look at the flip side of Ipswich, where the investment has been taken away from the football side, it's been taken away from the youth side particularly as well. It's a team in freefall, and you know, I think unfortunately they only looked one place the club's going to go. I think Paul Lambert's gone in there. I think he's brought in about 7 players either on loan or on free transfers in January, but he's been given no real money. The club and particularly the playing staff needed a massive overhaul of investment in the summer. It didn't happen, and they're going to pay the price for it.
On this podcast, we have a lot of aspiring goalkeepers, a lot of goalkeeper coaches, and it's grown certainly over the weeks we've been doing this. We're now getting thousands of listeners every week, so a big thank you to all of our listeners for that. And we always like to finish the podcast with a similar question, and we have had a lot of very experienced goalkeepers, some big names, and obviously now including yourself. And the question we ask, what has goalkeeping given to you?
What has it given to me? Oh, the obvious answer would be, you know, the financial rewards that come along with football. But the bigger picture for me is the reward it gives me to myself. When I had a period of time out of football, I was bored. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. And football gives me direction. It gives me stability. It gives me everything that I need to operate in my life. I've reached a point, I believe, in my life that I actually can't operate without football. In some capacity, whether I've got to be on the radio, whether I'm doing coaching. It was my ultimate dream to become a footballer, and I lived that dream, and I was very fortunate. I reached an age where I had to retire off the back of it. I now do the second best thing for me in the world. To me, it's the hardest job, it's the worst job in the world being a footballer, but it's the greatest job, and it gives you the greatest satisfaction. And I do the second greatest thing at this moment in time after doing the first greatest thing. So for me, It's my whole life. It encumbers my life fully.
Andy, great way to finish this chat. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're just going to touch on the weekend's action very quickly. Firstly, Bernd Leno, double save. Talk to me.
Fantastic. And it's, I think his comments alluded to this afterwards, where it was something he didn't really know too much about because it was so instinctive. But credit to him, excellent first save, spread well, a block technique. But he just got himself up very, very quickly, and it was a speed of reactions to get that big left hand, big left paw up to the ball and deflect it over. Had very, very little reaction time, but it was an excellent save and in the end, very vital.
John Ruddy, I'm going to move on to next, because this is a really interesting scenario and something that was a purposeful decision from Nuno Espirito Santo, the Wolves manager. He brought John Ruddy in this weekend to play against Cardiff, but he's already said that Rui Patricio is going to play against Chelsea next weekend. Now, this was a tactical decision because Rui Patricio struggled against Cardiff because they're a physical side and John Ruddy is a much bigger goalkeeper. So Nuno Espirito Santo, who of course was a goalkeeper in his playing days, brought John Ruddy in not only to sharpen him up, as it were, ahead of their FA Cup tie with United, because he made that error against Shrewsbury as well. So it gave him an opportunity to redeem himself there ahead of playing against Man United. But also, he was a more physical threat to Cardiff's attack.
Yeah, fascinating. I think that what you're seeing is goalkeepers that are suited to different situations. You could argue, and this is no disrespect to Ruddy, but Ruddy in the Championship last season was a phenomenal goalkeeper. You know, certainly top three in the Championship last season. Is he a top-end Premier League goalkeeper? The only reason I'd say no is because of how the Premier League has changed and goalkeeping has changed. And you've got the likes of, obviously, Rui Patricio being one of the outstanding talents this season, but Edison, Alisson, very different types of goalkeeping to what John Ruddy is used to. So a game against Cardiff, and this is probably slightly disrespectful for Cardiff, but they are effectively playing against a championship-style team in some of the ways they play. They're not your stereotypical Premier League team. They are that bit more physical. We've seen certain goalkeepers that have struggled with the physicality. Sergio Rico's a good example, where he has struggled aerially over and over this season, and teams have exploited that to an extent. So it's a really interesting call from the manager. It paid off. Great news for Ruddy. And we spoke about Ruddy before on this show, I'm sure, about him being one of the best number twos in the Premier League. And I stand by that. He offers something a little bit different. And it wouldn't surprise me if this isn't the only time that we see Wolves do this.
John Ruddy, of course, also established himself at Norwich City, which is exactly where our guest today, Andy Marshall, established himself. Yep. Really, really good chat that.
Yeah, I loved it. The bit that I loved in particular, so much I could pull out of that chat. But and I'll break it down to the stretching of comfort zones. And he spoke about it in a slightly different way. But I went and watched a warm-up of his recently, and I loved it. And I'm such a geek. I went there at 2 o'clock, and I sat there through the whole warm-up and loved every minute, because it was very different to what I've seen before, where you can see sometimes that goalkeepers, they go through the motions a bit in the warm-up, but then what happens, they go into the game and they're not quite to the speed of the game. You imagine that you've gone through a very simple warm-up and then suddenly you're getting a shot from 25 yards blasted in the top corner. Are you prepared for that shot if you haven't done that in the warm-up? And watching him, he is giving it everything when he's striking the ball at both the goalkeepers. And you can see the goalkeepers are coming off from the warm-up with a bit of a sweat on, which is absolutely fine for a goalkeeper, because you don't work that hard during a game. Aerobically, you don't work that hard. So to get yourself prepared, to make sure that your eyes are seeing the ball when it's being struck with that ferocity, that's what's going to get you ready for the game. And certainly the game that I saw, his goalkeeper was excellent in the game, Dylan Phillips. And I've got no doubt it's because of the work that Andy's been doing with him behind the scenes, and certainly the warm-up. He was more than ready for that game. And I think that Andy Marshall's a name that we're going to see more and more in the goalkeeping world as he continues to progress up the ranks.
Yeah, absolutely. Top bloke. And a great anecdote on Roy Keane as well. Yeah. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Okay, well, that's it for another week. Good show, mate.
I've enjoyed it, as always.
Good.
I hope you have too.
Absolutely. Remember, if there's anything you'd like us to discuss on the show, just let us know on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, on Facebook, just search GK Union, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon.